topic I'd like to speak about this evening, of course, is Chronicles. I'd like to try to provide a certain perspective on what is unique about this particular holiday. Let me begin with the Gemara and Shabbos. The Gemara and Shabbos of Kabbalah for the days has a very strange, very peculiar formulation. A very famous one and a very peculiar one. The Gemara begins with the word "My Chanukah." What is Chanukah? Not how do we know Chanukah, not what do we celebrate on Chanukah, but the word "My Chanukah," a very peculiar beginning. Then the Gemara explains, the Tanur Rabbanan, as we learned, the Chafei, the Kislev, Yomi the Chanukah, Tzman Yefimah. On the 25th day of Kislev begins the period of Chanukah, a period of 8 days. The Lom of Nisbeh Bahon, the Lom of Anosah. These days, right, one is supposed to focus on Simcha, Chodah. Consequently, one is prohibited from eulogizing on them, from fasting, etc. Then the background is given. When the Greeks entered into the Heichal of the Beit HaMikdash, they made impure, ritually impure, all of the shmanim, all of the oils from the Heichal. Because when the house of Chashmonaim overcame them, defeated them militarily, they only found one cruse of oil, which had the stamp of the Kohen Gadol, establishing that it was indeed tahor, ritually pure. Of course, it only lasts one day. And now the nace, however, a miracle occurred, the Hidlikum and the Shmoni Yamin, and that the kindling of the menorah lasted 8 days. The Shana Acheres, Kibaum, Vatsaum, Yimem Yamin, Tovin, Bahalel, Adam. In years to come, they established this as a holiday, which we call, of course, Hanukkah, and it became days of Shemach and Adar. Several things are striking. Firstly, I mentioned this term, my Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah? It's almost an unparalleled usage. We don't really find this kind of opening or description with respect to other holidays. For example, the parallel of Hanukkah generally is Purim. Purim and Chanukah share so much in common that it's almost difficult to distinguish between them. The theme of Chrisim and Nisa pervades both of them. Both of them are holidays that focus on a Yom Chol, don't really transform it into a Yom Kodesh exactly, into a Mikra Kodesh, a Pitzu Malacha. No, the Chanukah and Purim are regular routine days, but in which we focus on the celebration of the days. So in general, there's a lot of parallels between Purim and Chanukah. I say it's difficult to distinguish even between them. Indeed, the Rambam, in Hilchos Chanukah, says, chooses as a formulation that whoever is obligated to mitzvah, to Gilas Esther, Purim is obligated to Chanukah as well. It would have been almost as easy for the Rambam simply to list those people who he's referring to or to exclude those people who he needs to exclude. But the Rambam intentionally invokes Purim in the context of Chanukah, because there is so much parallel and similarity between them. And yet we don't find such a parallel formulation with regard to Purim or any other Chag. What is my Chanukah? More important, what's striking about the account, of course, and this is discussed by many people, is the de-emphasis of the military victory in favor of the focus on the days of the Sheva, the Pach Sheva. Question is, why? After all, the surface, it would appear that the greater miracle, certainly the more necessary miracle, was the military victory. All Israel found themselves in dire straits. Had they not been able to overcome militarily, right, they would have been doomed. It would appear that anything else pales into significance in light of that one single enormous reality. To be sure, the significance of military victory does register, and even in halachic sources. The Aladisim that we say in the Tzvilah and the Samazam, obviously we speak of military victory, we focus on it. In the Tzikta Rabati, which has an interesting discussion and description of the Nes Chanukah, the emphasis on the military victory. Even in Sifrei Halacha, later Sifrei Halacha, we find emphasis on this motif. For example, the Abu Dram tries to explain that Chanukah is really a reference, or really broken up into the words chadu ka. they camped when they defeated the Greeks, Kafe, Hanukkah, on the 25th day. That's his way, again, it's, you know, it's more of a hint than it is really a source, but that's his way of bringing the military victory into the forefront of discussions of the nature of Hanukkah. The Pri Chadash, answering the famous question posed by the Tilsa, so everybody knows this question, numerous books, and every year they come out with a new book, 200, 500, 700 answers to the question of the Beis Yosef. They told them to ask the question, why is it that we celebrate all 8 days? After all, the miracle was really 7 days, not 8 days. Right? First day, or the first day, there wasn't enough shemen, there wasn't enough oil to for the menorah to burn. So really the miracle was 7 days, not 8 days. All sorts of answers have been given, very interesting answers, have been given to this question. The Pri Chadash's response is that 7 days we celebrate the miracle of the Pach Shemen, and 1 day we celebrate the military victory. First day we celebrate the military victory. So again, this theme of the military victory, even though it's played down in the Gemara, certainly echoes not only halachic sources, but this is already a halachic issue. Right? We wouldn't be able to make brachos, and Nixon couldn't say all of these things if not the fact that the miracle extends all 8 days, or the Chadash extends 8 days because we include victory as well. For example, the Nitzin, in one of his chumos, suggests that when one makes the Shechiyanu in the first night, that he had in mind not only the mitzvah of Hadlakas Neros Chanukah, but he had in mind the celebration or commemoration of the military victory as well. Again, so we're inserting, we find this idea of insinuating or inserting the military victory into our actual commemoration, the brachos, the kavanah of the brachos, associated more primarily with the mitzvah of Hadlakas Neros. Some Minhagim, Sfarad for example, is to read the Megillas Antiochus, which again focuses on the details of the military victory. And yet, even though there are these echoes, they're precisely that, they're echoes. Clearly the Pach HaShemen is far more central in the Gemara and in halachic practice. What we do on Hanukkah primarily is focus on the Neros and all of the different permutations, which I'll discuss a little later on. And that undoubtedly raises several issues. Why do we focus, as I said before, on something which occurred after the revolt, when the revolt itself, the military victory, were necessary, more necessary, and they were far more critical. Moreover, if we're simply focusing on the miracle of the Nes, of the Pach HaShemen, the truth is that there are parallel miracles, or so we're told in the Gilas Tanis. Gilas Tanis is a record of miraculous occurrences that took place, for which days were set aside to commemorate, again, the Lola Nitzvei Behold, the Lola Anosol. There will be no eulogies and no fasting on those days because they commemorated these joyous events, these special meetings. So if you look at that work, you find that very many miracles took place during the same era. And yet, the Gilas Tanis was the Taylor. I mean, those days that are delineating Gilas Tanis and days of celebrating and commemorating miracles, those days were at one point, the commemoration was canceled. With the exception, of course, of Purim and Hanukkah. So, for example, we're told in literature that the time of Shimon HaTzadik, the Ner Maravi, was not extinguished. The Ner Maravi would continue to burn. That's something which is even substantively quite parallel to the days of Pach HaShemen, maybe it's even a more impressive miracle. So why is it, if we're focusing on the miracle, not on the military victory, something a miraculous event, what it implies about the existence of Hashgacha, according to Klal Yisrael. So why is it that specifically we give so much stature to the Nes of Hanukkah and its Pach HaShemen and not to comparable miracles that occurred in the same period which went out with the Gilas Tanis? Maybe even more dramatically, the difficulty is captured by the famous question raised in the 16th century by Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi. Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi is well known to everyone, I assume, who are very famous Perush on Rashi LaTorah. He also wrote the Sefer Nei Halakha, Shemus HaTshuvos, and Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi. And he raises this famous question. Well, the principle is that Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur. Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur means that if Klal Yisrael's ritual impurity is an obstacle for the entire Tzibur accomplishing a particular mitzvah, it's a mikdash, then Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur. And the principle is they can go ahead, Klal Yisrael can observe that performance, whatever it may be, Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur. In those conditions, since the entire Tzibur is affected, so the status of Tumah is not going to be an obstacle. For example, this is an important issue. You can bring it from Pesach, it wrote in the Klal Yisrael, the entire Tzibur were insane, and other such things. The question is, if Tumah is Hutra Tzibur, well, no question, if one can proceed despite the status of ritual impurity of Tumah, as long as the entire Tzibur's ability to accomplish the mitzvah is affected, so then it turns out that the entire nes of Ner Hanukkah may have simply been superfluous. They have been unnecessary. Klal Yisrael, the Tzibur, could not proceed because the Hashemen that was assigned to that one, everything else was in the category of Tumah. But they would have had to proceed because they had to light the menorah and the mikdash. And Tumah would have been hutra B'Tzibur. So why focus on the unnecessary, on the superfluous, on the gratuitous nes, when you have the option of focusing instead on something which is indispensable, which was the centerpiece of the struggle itself, without which, never mind, there wouldn't have been days, there wouldn't have been very much more than that. This superfluity, this idea that the Nes Pashemet was excessive, which wasn't really necessary, is also reflected by another prominent position in Yerushalayim, particularly among Chachmei Pravat. The Rabbi Abad, the Baal Sefer Heshkol, and his son-in-law, the Raibid, and the Meiri, all of them suggest that in theory, there would have been access to Shemen Tahar even earlier than 8 days. The only reason it was necessary to wait for 8 days is because the creme de la creme of Shemen Zayas, the best Shemen Zayas, was to be found in Tekoa. And to go back and forth to Tekoa and to retrieve this oil took 8 days. The question arises, why bother with the best available oil in Tekoa if that means delaying the shemen that's going to be used in the menorah? Very peculiar. If you have the option of going to Tekoa and getting the preferred shemen, Zayas, and of course, you know, one should do so. It's always better to perform mitzvah in a manner which reflects being a chila, rather than to simply perform it in a minimal way. But if we're talking about a soak and alabe, we're not relying on miracle, if we're talking about the ability to have the menorah light during this period, why go all the way to Tekoa to achieve this goal, this aspiration, at the expense of what would appear to be more basic performance? Beit Halevi raised a similar question. He argues that really they could have worked with the wicks, and I'm hardly an expert in these matters, so I'll rely on Beit Halevi, but one could have shaved the wicks in such a way as to use consume less oil, and maybe the same oil that would ideally burn only one day, given the thick wicks, which provided a great deal of illumination. But maybe you could have used that same oil and accomplished 8 days with very thin wicks, albeit you wouldn't have had as bright a kindling. So again, the question arises, ain't some colonies, and they've already discussed it, why is it that they chose this path, they chose to pursue Tekoa and the normal wicks of the wicks, when they had other options available to them? The Chacham Tzvi just a partial solution to the issue of Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur, but one which doesn't resolve the other problem. The Chacham Tzvi argues that it's true of Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur, but the point here was the haros lahem chiva yisayla. The purpose of the days, though it was superfluous, indeed it was superfluous. Without the days, they would have been able to proceed and light the menorah in any case. But the fact is that this is a way of the Ribbono Shel Olam demonstrating or giving a reinforcing the events that had just recently taken place, the military victory and the affected themselves on the limb in order to pursue that victory. So the Haris Lahim Chibay Seira, to underscore his affection for Klal Yisrael, he immediately responded, no Kamira. But that again doesn't explain some of the other phenomena, A. B, it certainly doesn't explain why that date emerges as a central symbol when it appears to be superfluous, and the alternative symbol, military victory, remains certainly, according to everybody, indispensable. I'd like to suggest, however, it's quite simple, but just to turn around 180 degrees the entire assumption. That is, that the religious, spiritual, didactic significance of the holiday of Hanukkah is precisely due to the fact that the nais of Tzach HaShemen was superfluous. Precisely because it was unnecessary, and that one could have proceeded even in the important work of the Mikdash itself without it, precisely for that reason, it reflects what is unique about Hanukkah, and even underscores what was important about the military victory. And by the same token, the military victory, because it was indispensable, once the war was launched, once the commitment was made, it was a matter of life and death. Precisely because it was necessary that they be victorious, precisely for that reason, it emerges as an inappropriate symbol of the actual holiday and religious significance of Christ. Everybody's familiar with the famous comment of the Lavush. The Lavush, commenting on an issue I raised earlier, what is the relationship between Purim and Hanukkah? Well, they seem very, very similar in many respects. You have to deal with the Sinagisa, the fact that you do the same celebration, and yet remains Yom Kol. Indeed, the Yerushalmi, the Sakatanis, seems to indicate that even if other laws it might be potatoes, I don't know exactly what this means, the Asir Lava, the Asir Mashiach, the Hanukkah and Purim, those will remain, they will endure. In many respects, Hanukkah and Purim are equated. What then, wherein then lies the difference? So the Bush, in a famous comment, suggests that when it comes to Purim, it was the physical existence of Klal Yisrael that was really its nature. After all, the decree there was to destroy Klal Yisrael completely, literally kill them. And the survival, the physical survival, therefore represents the focal point of celebration, the Nafochu, and that's the reason why there's so much emphasis on eating, and drinking, and on Loyada. Again, it's not important now, so it's for another time. But this physical survival aspect is reflected in many of the details of the halakhos, of course. On the other hand, when it came to Hanukkah, with which argues, it wasn't the physical survival of Klal Yisrael that was an issue, it was really their spiritual survival. And that too is reflected in a whole different series of symbols and of themes and of motifs that apply on this day. What does the Lavush, however, really mean? After all, we're talking about a military death, a military struggle, we're talking about life and death, we're talking about physical survival as opposed to extinction. In what sense is this only or primarily a spiritual struggle? The answer, however, is quite simple, and it's found, I think, what's expressed best in the Rambam. The issue really revolves around a simple halachic question. Was there really an obligation for Klal Yisrael to wage this war? Because no one will deny that once they were involved in military conflict, that then became a matter of survival, right? It was necessary to actually emerge victorious. No one will deny that. The question is, was it necessary for them to challenge the Greek control to begin with? After all, we have a principle, the Chayva Himaloshiyam's plan. That principle states quite unequivocally that human value of human life, survival, supersedes almost all, with very few exceptions. The principle is that in the case of Pikuach Nefesh, when one's life is at stake, Yavor al Yavor. The person is allowed to submit to the pressure in order to save his own life. Indeed, Rambam's position is that the nais lo'avar, the person is obligated to save his life rather than, even at the expense of violating mitzvot, that the nais lo'avar, he tries to be more righteous than he should, a reason to chai b'nafsho. Rambam doesn't perceive that as righteousness, The Rambam castigates such an individual because he's a mitzchayim in Hashem. Others have disagreed with the position of Rambam. So from this perspective, if we were to narrowly focus on every individual action for each individual day in the life of Klal Yisrael in a period of Greek control, where Greek culture obviously imposed the limits on the ability to perform mitzvot, Matzara, Mashkicha, Matarasecha, Mavir, Mechukim, Tzonecha, etc., then the response, in a narrow sense, on the surface, should have been Yavo la Yaharik, and there should have been no need at all to wage this kind of battle. On the contrary, it should have been inappropriate. However, there are, as is well known, exceptions to the rule of Yavo la Yaharik. There are essentially three groups of suggestions, of exceptions. One is the Gibel of Eros, the three cardinal of Eros, about which we always say Yaharik la Yavo, like murder, Gibel Arayos, immorality, and about his own. Those are three. And then, of course, are two other circumstances which also demand Yaharik la Yavo. One is if the challenge is issued by Hestia, especially if it's perceived as a religious challenge, or Hestia requires a response to Yaharik la Yavo. And then, of course, there's one final requirement to Yaharik la Yavo, and that is the principle of Shas Hashmat. A person living in a time of religious crisis, where some external force imposes its will, right, and curbs religious expression, Shas Hashmat, Shas HaZera, and in that situation, even Arkas of the Mitzvah, even the tiniest minog, requires the response of Yaharik la Yavo. Relevant parakei of Chutzpah Yatharma expresses it as follows, and of course provides the most famous example of this category. Kol Adbar Ma'elu Shalom B'Shas HaZera. Of B'Shas HaZera, the time of religious crisis, Hu She'yavod Melech Rasha K'nehu Chatetza V'Chadera, the Yigzar Zera on Yisrael. Kol Yisrael is under the gun spiritually, again, religion is being prohibited, the Vatel Datan, all mitzvot are mitzvot. Even if it isn't a religious decree which completely neutralizes all of religious expression, but focuses on particular mitzvot, Yehareg Valyavar, Afilo Al Akas, Nishar mitzvot, Vendenas, Vedachasara, Vendenas, Vedal, Vedal, Vedal. Even if it's simply a private challenge between you and the Anas, between you and the person who's trying to compel you or coerce you to refrain from religious expression, if it's Shas Hashmat, it's seen as part of a campaign to curb your adherence to Yadus, then the Rambam says, according to Gemara in Sanhedrin, the principle of Yaharik la Yavo. The question is, well, we understand Parhesia, but let's say this way. We understand the Gibel Averos, it's quite possible that there are some things that are valued beyond people. Taking another life, an expression of basic commitment and loyalty and allegiance to Judaism, Kabbalah Zara, taking another life, Gilei Arayos, the whole area of adultery and related behavior, which undermines the dignity and basic humanity of the individual. So there are certain things that go beyond Pikuach Nefesh, beyond B'chaim Bohem, below Shiyamasa. If we're speaking about Parhesia, you have to understand that as well. For all, what impact, what tremendous impact, might a public submission to this kind of pressure have on others? Right, the Chil Hashem is enormous. Chil Hashem requires a response of Yaharik la Yavo. But what about Shas Hashmat? Afilu Beino Mabein HaAnos. A matter of private, no one knows about it, pressure is being put on this individual by another individual. Why do we have to respond in this circumstance, Yaharik la Yavo? And it says, in his commentary on the Shulto, an extremely interesting comment. There he suggests that in the context of Shas Hashmat, a time of religious crisis where the government imposes these kinds of restrictions and makes everything a matter of principle, testing the allegiance and the loyalty of Klal Yisrael, in that circumstance, even Arkas of the Mitzvah, even a Min of Bialma, the details are not important for the moment, is really transformed and in some level into a Vadizara. What does that mean? How can literally Arkas of the Mitzvah, according to some means, the time of Shulayt, a certain minute, that's why Shulayt is now the Min of Yisrael, and that was attacked in time of religious crisis, in the man to respond to the hard way out. Seems very harsh. How could that turn into a bozal? I think if one thinks about it, it becomes eminently clear. Just use a quick mashal. The Gemara Sanhedrin tells us that the Nachash HaKamoni, the Nachash who tricked, convinced Chava into the first terrible sin, the sin that was responsible for the expulsion of Adam and Chava from Canaan, that he was a Mason. The classic Mason, the person who incites, is a Nachash, and then the Nachash is Chayat Nisa, he's a Mason. So the Achronim on that Gemara brings a very simple, straightforward question. In all of Halakhic literature, Mason is associated with the Avodah Zarah. The person who incites the Avodah Zarah. Sutra, Sanhedrin, Rama, Avodah Zarah. Mason is one who incites the Avodah Zarah. We understand that such an individual is liable to death penalty on the basis of his incitement to Avodah Zarah. The Nachash didn't incite the Avodah Zarah. The Nachash incited to the eating of the forbidden fruit. In what sense that Mason, in a parallel way to the basis of Avodah Zarah? I think the answer is quite simple. Mason per se does not refer to Avodah Zarah. Mason refers to religious loyalty and allegiance. All things being equal, once mitzvahs were given, once there was an Avodah Zarah in the world, that Mason expresses itself in Avodah Zarah. Because the ultimate disloyalty, the ultimate lack of allegiance is for somebody who believes in God, right, to worship another God. And maybe now, in that period of time where there is such a concept as Avodah Zarah, the only basis is the basis of Avodah Zarah. But at the time of the Nachash HaKadoni, in the time of the Nachash, there was only one obligation that other than Kaaba had to observe. And that was not to eat from the Eitz HaDaat. In that context, the Nachash, who attempted to incite rebellion against the Ribono Shel Olam, was the Mason. The concept of Mason, indeed, on some level, the concept of Avodah Zarah, is not just technically the issue of worshipping another god. It's an issue that revolves around this question of allegiance and of loyalty. Here's another quick example. There's a big discussion in Halakhic literature in defining about the definition of Avodah Zarah for purposes of the Yahari Baliyahu. But quite a few Rishonim who suggest, for example, that Islam, as opposed to Christianity, does not really qualify for Avodah Zarah. After all, Christianity believes in the Trinity. The Trinity is a negation of the unity of God, and therefore a basic tenet, basic principle in our concept of monotheism, and constitutes Avodah Zarah for Jews. Maybe not for non-Jews, but for Jews, Christianity constitutes Avodah Zarah. Islam, on the other hand, believes in the Prophet. And the Prophet Muhammad, which we certainly reject fully, but there's nothing on the theological side of Islam which in any way undermines the theological concept of Yahdut, and therefore technically Islam may not qualify as Muslim. However, there's a tshuva of the Radbaz, which the Radbaz argues nonetheless that Yahari Baliyahu applies to Islam. Other posts, some disagree. What does the Radbaz have in mind? Not a different theological conception of Islam. But the Radbaz is essentially arguing, I think, is that the concept of Yahari Baliyahu, which relates to Avodah Zarah, does not require technical Avodah Zarah. The real issue is the question of loyalty and allegiance. And from that perspective, even if technically observing this other religion of Islam, doesn't constitute theological Avodah Zarah, it certainly does constitute a complete lack of breakdown of loyalty and allegiance. The point is that Shas HaShmad, in this sense, I think this is what we're talking about, the context of Shas HaShmad in which one is being dared to defy religious coercion, in which one is being dared essentially to practice his religion and to exhibit his loyalty and allegiance to Halakha and Ziyadot. In that context, even Arkas of the Masana on some level becomes a Vadazara. In the sense that it becomes a testing ground, not only for one's faith, but for one's loyalty and one's allegiance. Even if you don't accept that it's history, Rashi and Sanhedrin have a very clear formulation of Shas HaShmad as drawing a line in the sand and saying, Adkan. In other words, the idea of Shatashtav, if you want to take away from technical of Dara, is the idea that if you look narrowly at each coercion, every moment of isolation, spiritual oblivion, or at minimum spiritual mediocrity, the necessity to draw that line in the sand and say, I've come, no more, even to the point of sacrificing one's life, Yehari Valyabor, becomes compelling. In other words, Shatashmad establishes the principle that religious mediocrity as a way of life, religious mediocrity or the Vyavet or reliance upon Yahuwah Yahare, when institutionalized across the board, not simply applied narrowly in particular circumstances, becomes totally unacceptable. There's a principle in halakha that goes as follows, stated specifically with regard to the korban mincha, kol roi levila ein vila makabes. Kol she'ein roi levila, vila makabes. It's referring to the mixing of the ingredients of mincha, but the idea basically is, when there is a certain mechatchila, preferable, ideal way to perform a mitzvah, and you have the capacity to do it, but you ignore that capacity, then the yedet, you can fulfill the mitzvah. But kol she'ein roi levila, when you don't have the capacity to observe the mitzvah of the chatzchila in its most ideal setting, under those conditions, the mitzvah cannot be performed as a b'di'evet either. Essentially, in the time of Chashmonaim, the leadership came to be convinced that they were living in a state of spiritual mediocrity, that slowly but surely they were being, their religiosity was being eaten away at through the mechanism of Yavah Balyahari, that no longer could they, even if they wished, engage in mitzvot, never mind in an ideal performance of mitzvot, mechatchila. Consequently, they proceeded as Shatashmad with the response of Yehari Layama. But if this is the case, then what really emerges is that the concept of mechatchila, the concept of living a life of halakha in a maximal and an ideal way, essentially, is what constitutes the underpinning for the decision to go to war. In other words, this recognition that spiritual mediocrity leads to spiritual oblivion, which is no quality of life at all, and which demands even the radical response of the Yehari Valyavar, essentially rests on a certain appreciation of the concept of that which is unnecessary, but that which is ideal. If this is the case, then the ultimate symbol, the most appropriate symbol for Hanukkah, was not going to be the indispensable military victory once the commitment had been made to fight the battle. On the contrary, what was going to be the ultimate symbol was going to be that which was superfluous, not necessary, but which reflected the commitment to the ideal and to the Chatzchila. From this perspective, the Mokhama was disqualified, and the Neis Chanukah emerged as the ideal. The first post-revolt act set the tone which justified the decision to engage in battle to begin with. And if that's the case, then it became necessary not only to forego Tumma Hutra the Tzibur, what message would have emerged if the first post-revolt action had been one which relied upon a terror, similar to the simple, even in a very fine cause. Instead, the ideal of a chatzchila was going to be pursued. And not only the chatzchila which eschewed Tumahutra B'Tzibur, but even pursuing the creme de la creme of Shemen Zayazach from Tekoa, the best that could be found. Maybe even using those wicks in their full width so that the illumination could be at its utmost, rather than simply relying upon cutting them down to make do with the shemen that remains. If this is the case, then we can also understand the terminology of the Gemara by Hanukkah. The Gemara is not simply describing the historical background or describing how it is we observe Hanukkah. The Gemara is asking a fundamental question which maybe is not necessary to ask in other contexts. The Gemara is asking here, what is the essence of Hanukkah? What is unique and singular What is its primary theme and motif? By Chanukah. And the Gemara's response is, the essence of Chanukah is the Nes Pa'ashem. Precisely because of its superfluous nature, even though the background happens to be the Mokama, the indispensable military victory. If this is the case, then perhaps you can understand some of the unique halachic aspects of this holiday. The truth is that we find in many chagim, and in many performances, the theme of Zekeinu Vaneinu. Zekeinu Vaneinu, we're told, install the panav b'mitzvah, where a person should put his best foot forward. You should have the best possible rule of an astronaut, the nicest pair of villain, this audience, or other audience. Whatever the case, whatever the mitzvah that one is engaged in, doesn't really matter, it should be installed upon the mitzvah. We even encounter Zekeinu Vaneinu, which transforms mitzvah. We find that the qualitative performance of mitzvah is affected by performing it in the most ideal fashion. For example, Misha says in Sukkot, Lulav and Yavesh, it's possible that a dried out lulav is qualified, can't be used for mitzvah. So the Rashi explains, although it's a controversial situation, Rashi explains that the reason that the lulav and Yavesh is possible is because of Zekeinu Vaneinu. The requirement that is thrown upon a mitzvah. Do the mitzvah in a proper way, in a beautiful way, in a way which adorns the performer. All the immediately ask, how can that be? The Zekeinu Vaneinu was an achila, it's an ideal, but certainly not the lahake. Might be that in the context of there being a concept of Hadar, the Zekeinu Vaneinu becomes lahake as well. He tells us what is important. What I'm trying to point out is that sometimes the Zekeinu Vaneinu even transforms the quality of performance of a list. For example, when it comes to it with Mila, we're told that Sitzin, Sheinim, Hakim, Samila, details of performing it, there are some details which are only lechatzila, based on Zekeinu Vaneinu. And yet, even if a person has to perform a bris milah on Shabbos, so you might think that he would be limited to what he has to do, because the bris milah is don't have Shabbos, but he shouldn't do any more. But the fact is that if he's involved directly in bris milah, he can even be involved in Sitzin, Sheinim, Hakim, Samila, based on Zekeinu Vaneinu. He can't come back to it if he stops, but he will have to do it in the context of the performance. Again, this idea that occasionally we find that the ideal performance is qualitatively different and transforms the nature of the performance. It's not simply a quantitatively better way to accomplish it. However, whatever interesting manifestations of Zekeinu Vaneinu we find in Shabbos, on Tarakuma, nothing compares to Nero's Kanata. Here, after all, we have specific and detailed kidurim. Right, you have Yerush Beso, then you have Mahadrin, then you have Mahadrin and Mahadrin. Nowhere else do you have three levels, two additional levels, to be sure. Moreover, that the two are specified, not just in a nicer way, a better way, the preferred way, but a different way. And in some ways, a totally different way. Especially according to our practice, according to Ramah, that the Mahadrin and the Mahadrin is not a candle, is not a menorah that is lit for the whole household, the whole group, but each individual light itself. So the Mahadrin of Mahadrin not only is somewhat transformed, it totally changes the nature of the performance. It takes it from a household performance, a collective act, to an individual one. Moreover, we find all sorts of very fascinating issues for us. For example, the principle is that Birchas HaMitzvah, the bracha that you make of the mitzvah, should be over lasiyasa, should be made prior to the actual performance, or the action state. Pick up the Lulav and Esrog, the Alamina, and you have to make the bracha before, that's why people take them down, etc. I always make the bracha before you do the performance. What happens in Nero's Chanukah, not on the first night, but on other nights, where you already lit the first candle? Are you in violation of the principle of Omelas Yasam if you make the bracha after the first candle but before the other candles, or not? In other words, you're over lasiyasan of the Mahadrin, you're Mahadrin, but you're not over lasiyasan of the basic mitzvah of Yerush Beisal of Chanukah. This is a very interesting discussion. Rabbi Yehuda Eger discussed it, another of the post-Gemara discussed it. what's the proper obanasiyasa? Obviously, preferable for anything. If you did already light the first candle, can you still speak of obanasiyasa? Again, this reflects that the mahadran of mahadran, not just a nicer way to do it, a better way to do it, rather, it entirely transforms the entire performance. So now suggesting that even though you lit one candle, and that's enough for the Yerusha basic, the basic performance of the mitzvah, nonetheless, since it's a concept of mahadran of mahadran, you're still able to ask the outcome in some sense. Almost as if we're ignoring the base for the sake of or in light of the mahadran of mahadran. For example, Rambam's rules of halacha, people only have its parnes in Astaka, even somebody who is poverty stricken, impoverished, his mocher suso, he sells his, literally sells his clothes in order to buy shenet, in order to buy oil for their house. Very striking stuff. Question where exactly he gets it from, double tradition says something similar. But this idea that even an ani would sell something basic, subsistence, provisions, resources, in order to be able to fulfill his commandment, this mitzvah is very striking. You don't have limitations on the performance of mitzvahs generally, and certainly mitzvah kafila, chomesh, the fifth and more than Christ, etc. All of a sudden, in the context of Hanukkah, we find all these exceptions. We find that the Mahadran, the lengths that we go to in order to accomplish the mitzvah, appear to be accepted. Again, not everybody agrees with this. It's certainly just the position of them. If this is the case, the question is why? But if the entire symbol of Hanukkah is the Pachadeh Pachashemet, which itself is superfluous, and if that's so because of its superfluity, then precisely that symbol because of this commitment to the Chakila and to the Ordo Mitzvot to their utmost maximum, and that's the reason why they engaged in battle to begin with, and people on Yad Veri Yahore, that is the secret behind the whole concept of Shach HaShemad. But of course, the fact that this would be reflected in the details of the Halakos of Hanukkah is truly reasonable. Not just reasonable, it's very compelling. So we understand very well why the Hadran on the Hadran emerges in such a central position. We understand why Akhil Adi Hamid is. We understand why some of these manifestations come. In this slide, perhaps you can also understand a famous medrash and Ramban direction that medrash, if not even his exact interpretation. The medrash at the beginning of Alaska notes that Aaron HaKohen was very unhappy that the Kohanim were excluded from the Hanukkah Tomateh. The Hanukkah Sumbeah. Hanukkah Sumbeah, of course, involved the Messiah, the Messiah of each shape. The Kohanim were excluded. So, Aaron HaKohen complained, he was unhappy his tribe, his people had been excluded from this process, and he was mollified, he was consoled, he was appeased by being told that one day there would be Neros, the Lakas Neros, which would compensate for his exclusion from Hanukkah Sumbeah. What are these neros? That's not clear. So Rashi says in the first thing, we know it generally, the Ramban disagrees. The Ramban asks the same question, we give about Mosca. The Ramban says the reference here is to Neros Hanukkah. Essentially, what happened was, Aaron HaKohen complained, why were the Kohanim excluded from Hanukkah Tzeah? And he was appeased by being told one day your children, namely the Hashemites, were the Kohanim, they will be the leaders, they will be the ones by the light. The menorah of Hanukkah. It's not Indian menorah of Hanukkah, it's so Hanukkah Sabbatea, to reflect what I'm saying. What does one thing have to do with the other? I think the answer is really quite simple. The Hanukkah Sabbatea has been stood in its context. In Parshas Vayakhel, Rashi quotes the well-known Midrash that the Messiah, who came to the Trumas Mishkan, were displaying, let's say, an improper perspective. They took the attitude, they said, let the people donate what they're going to donate, and whatever's missing, in terms of fundraising, right, will complete. Now the truth is that what the museum said, on the surface, appears to be rather generous. I'm not a fundraiser by the source of that nation, but I think that, you know, that's a common problem. That kind of commitment is a fundraiser's dream. Somebody says, raise money, do the best you can, whatever is missing, whatever the deficit that remains, I'll take care of it. That's what the scene says. But the fact is that the Chazal criticizes the seer, and they argue that looking in there, when the seer is spelled out of yud. The letter was taken from their name because of their improper perspective, the fact that they didn't volunteer, and they simply stood back and waited and said, we'll make up the debt. So then what happened was, when it came to the Chanukah on the Zeach, the Messiah learned their lesson. That's what Chazal saying those later Sukkim and other Pasha, that they learned the lesson of what the mistake that had taken place in Mishkan. When it came to Chanukah on the Zeach, they were forefront and center. They were the ones who took the lead, the initiative in this Nidah. So in this context, I think perhaps suggests an explanation of the Ramah. The Ramah is saying as follows. The Chanukah on the Zeach represented this concept of voluntarism. And this idea of reason, this idea of embracing mitzvot enthusiastically, and not simply making sure that they get done so-so. Right? This was the Nassim's opportunity to shine after having misunderstood, right, the charge, the obligation to the time of the Mishkan. So Aaron HaKohen was upset. True, the Kohanim took the lead in the Shiva Tzinei HaMimurim, but when it came to Chanukah on the Zeach, which was Karbanos Nedava, there was all the Nedava of the Nassim, they had no role to play. Meaning, true, when it came to the Choma, to establishing the Miluim, the Kohanim were central. But the Kohanim also wanted to be central when they weren't obligated, when they were involved in Lechatchila, because that would have been an opportunity for them to display their enthusiasm and their overall commitment. And they were disappointed that they were excluded from this whole process and given solely to the Nassim. So as Ramban understands, it's not that fully, but there's some direction of that. What was the antidote? How were they caught in? How are the coin appeased? He was told, don't worry about it. One day, the Kohanim will have their chance as well, in the context of the menorah, in the context of Chanukah. So if indeed Chanukah is a symbol of the Chatchila, precisely of taking this initiative, of not relying upon, you know, the minimum, the yemen, not taking the approach of covering the deficit, but taking the initiative and volunteering and being central in the idealistic aspect. Then we understand very well that that ultimate symbol was captured by the revolt, by the motivation to revolt, which was of course led by the Kohanim today on the Kashmiraim, and of course by the theme of the Beit Pachshemen in the Beit HaMikdash, which again was accomplished by the hand of today our Kohen of the Kashmiraim. If this is the case, then perhaps we can also understand why it is that the Rosh Hashanah tells us at the Chesed of Days that the contrast between life under the Yevanim and life in the period of Hashmonai was that it's kinu shumaz kirin shem shamayim afim shtar. In the time of the Yevanim, it was prohibited for Klal Yisrael to mention the name of God. In the time of the Hashmonai, there was kirin shem shamayim afim shtar. The idea being that in the time of the Yevanim, there was no religious expression. It may have been because of the pressure and coercion. Again, you might have said on a minimalist basis, if taking the narrow view, Yavo Bal Yahari, because at the time when Rosh Yama's Bible. But the purpose of the revolt was to overthrow that, so that not only could it be Maskir Sheikh Shamayim in the religious context, but in a spiritual framework, in the context of doing mitzvot, but even a filu peshtavos. Even when one was simply involved in regular routine functions, like writing business contracts, there too, one convention, Shem Hashem. So the idea was to embrace the kind of lifestyle which was exact opposite in every way of the lifestyle under the Greeks. A lifestyle which allowed for pervasive religiosity and an idealistic expression of religion. If this is the case, then Chanukah really emerges as a paradigm for spiritual survival in a world of assimilation and acculturation, which is what the world of the Yevanim was, and unfortunately, the kind of world that we all too often encounter in our own period of time. The Rabbeinu Bachayim, in Kana Kebach, suggests that the word Hanukkah, of course related to Hanukkah from the Tzeach, is also related to the language of Chinuch, in the sense of Chanoch Hanar of the Darka. My implication is that Hanukkah is not just commemorated, but Hanukkah has major educational significance. It is supposed to bear a timeless message for all of us. Again, particularly in the kind of world that we live, more specifically, the place that we inhabit even within the religious community, I think this message is of special significance and importance. Many demands are made of us living in the modern world. Many pressures are brought to bear. Oftentimes, even sincere and idealistic people project the idea that one can be a Ben Torah and live in the modern world simply by not trampling upon, not violating the basic letter of the halakha. That way, one can embrace much of modernity and values. Well, if you're only interested in not trampling and avoiding the Yisurin and being technically within the orbit of halakha, there is a lot greater latitude and flexibility. However, clearly, that is not an acceptable way for any Jew to live in life. And that's really what Hanukkah conveys to us. It conveys to us that not trampling upon the Yisurin and living a life of Yavar, the Al Yehare, or even a life of Bidyevet, even if that Bidyevet is motivated, not in the case that we encounter generally, on the kind of dramatic attempt to cope religiosity and spirituality, like in the time of Mudim, they get based simply on the attractiveness of other values and of the surrounding culture. That too creates certain pressures. Clearly, this is not an acceptable condition. Clearly, Hanukkah makes the demand that we embrace enthusiastically all aspects of halakha, the lechatchila, the ideal, the most demanding, the most maximal expression of halakha. And that the values that we adopt and that we internalize be those values which are essentially rooted in, anchored in, the internal mechanisms of halakha and the dynamic of halakha. And from there, we adopt a certain worldview which allows us to examine and then ultimately to be selective about what other cultural influences are which cultural influences are consistent and which are antithetical to that idealistic embrace of a halakhic ideal value system. That truly is the message of Hanukkah, of Hanukkah Nar, of Pidato. And truly, if we were able to embrace that kind of lifestyle, then we will fulfill the words of Yerushalmi with which I close. And as Yerushalmi and Thomas I mentioned before, even if Kol HaMoed is a tailor, well, the other Moedim are rooted in a special conception of the Kodesh, comes to get there, they're taken out of time, not that they're taken out of time and space, but they're certainly taken out of Rukhdai's time. They're Mikra Kodesh. They represent a different kind of world. But Hanukkah and Purim, precisely because they are Yimei Kol, and yet they make ambitious spiritual and chassidic demands of us, despite the fact that we're in the context of Kol, they are truly enduring. And surely this message of the chassidic, of a maximalist embrace of the values of halakha, is particularly enduring, especially in our lives. Thank you very much.
I'm
suggesting that there's a certain aspect of Hanukkah which is different, and that the Purim, the physical survival, the actual survival of the Jews is what we celebrate, like Luhus said. And therefore, there's no need for a Bai Hanukkah because the obvious focus is also the actual focus. There's no need to find some other symbol to capture an essence which might be camouflaged by other critical events surrounding what it took place. We celebrate the death of the decree of Haman and the survival of the Jews and everything that took place with Mordechai and Esther, and there's no need for my father, though. You read the Megillah, and that's exactly what we have. phone call that. In the context of Hanukkah, there might be an Agilas Hanukkah, or its equivalent, or Hanukkah. The Mokama was in the background, it is indispensable, there's no question that on some level it is more basic than anything else. But we want to know by Hanukkah, what is the essence of the holiday, what is the theme to walk away from? It's not the survival, it's not even the war, it's not even the miracle in Hashkaka, it's all those things as well. But primarily, it's this embrace of a lifestyle of Hakhila, this idea that it's ideally has to be at the center of our spiritual tradition. Thank you very much.
Thank you.